In 1986, singer, songwriter, and producer Peter Gabriel opened the doors to his legendary Real World Studios in Wiltshire, England. Over the years, musicians from Bonnie Raitt to Deep Purple, from Robert Plant to Nigel Kennedy, have recorded at this former grain mill surrounded by sheep farms 100 miles west of London. But Real World has always been more than just a place for heavy hitters to lay down tracks and dash off mixes. Its mission has also been to provide a state-of-the-art space for musicians from around the world to meet and mingle, try out new sounds, and exchange ideas. In the early 90s, the studio opened for what was called Recording Weeks, and some 75 artists from 20 countries came to play. In those heady days of musical experimentation, artists recorded in every nook and cranny of the complex. So many tapes piled up, there soon became no room to store them. Today, almost two decades later, we finally will hear the fruits of that labor. On Tuesday, Big Blue Ball is released on Real World Records. Many points of the globe are represented on Big Blue Ball. There's Congolese singer Papa Wemba, Sinead O'Connor from Ireland, the Holmes Brothers with American gospel, string players from Egypt, percussionists from Japan, and flutists from China. And that is just a small sample. Peter Gabriel acted as curator and sings on several tracks, and he joins us now from his home in London. Hello, Peter. Welcome back to the program.
Hi, Leanne. Thank you very much.
So I guess the first and most obvious question is, what took so long for the CD to come out?
Well, as you said, we created a mountain of tapes. And I think every time that somebody looked at them, they sort of backed away. And we eventually found someone brave enough, Stephen Haig, who's here with me today, actually, with Carl Wallinger. He agreed to dive in there. Mm-hmm. And it took him several attempts over several years. But he was the man brave enough or foolish enough to try and sort out all the mess that we created. But, you know, it was a fertile mess, I think.
We're going to talk to Stephen and Carl in just a moment. But can I talk to you just a little bit about those recording weeks in the early 90s? You described it as a dating service with a 24-hour cafe.
Yeah, well, you know musicians.
Yeah.
I think we were trying to get a certain number of records done as well, but I think the exciting thing for a lot of us was that there were musicians from all over the world, sort of songwriters, poets, all thrown together, and all sorts of connections happened.
No rhyme or reason, no way to make it easy. It's done.
I think they are the most fun weeks I've ever had in the studio, without question, you know, and it's from a writer's point of view, it sort of takes you back to a time when, say, the Brill Building was full of songwriters and they'd come in at 9 o'clock and have a song by six when they went home.
Let's bring in another of this triumvirate. We're talking to co-producer Carl Wallinger from World Party and the Waterboys. Hey, Carl.
Hi.
Hi. You've described this project as something akin to providing a train and a track for the artists. So what was the journey like for you?
Well, sort of round in circles, probably. No, it wasn't really round in circles. No, it was just a great. It was a great thing. I was just asked by Peter to come along and sort of join in, and it was just like a musical health farm, really. There wasn't any considerations other than the sounds you heard in the room, you know, which were always pretty extraordinary and played by people who had been mastering their instrument in whatever way, you know, for however many years. I mean, I just think the collective musical years that had gone down amongst everybody there would have been sort of well into the thousands, you know.
How did the process work? I mean, you know, who was writing the songs? How did they evolve?
I think they just sort of came about, really. I mean, there'd be, if you're planning on getting people to play together on some unknown piece that doesn't really have any shape, we basically used a kind of rhythm or just a pulse of some sort we'd set up, and then we'd start laying things on the top.
thing, Stephen Haig?
Yes.
You really dug into this project to put it in some kind of manageable form. A very daunting task, surely. I mean, where did you begin?
Where did I begin? There was a lot of listening involved, and between me and Peter in particular, we narrowed it down. One thing that I ran by Peter as I digested some, you know, was quite familiar with what had been recorded, and had some thoughts about what, you know, where it could be taken, was what kind of latitude that I would have in creating final mixed versions of these tracks, besides editing the material that was there. And Peter said, as long as it ends up being a great record, whatever you think it takes. And I always tried to stay true to the spirit of the sessions, and just made sure that I wasn't losing track of the spirit of what had gone on.
Peter, did you have to mediate artistic differences?
No, actually, it was very easy. And Carl has a wicked sense of humor, too, which has kept most of us in hysterics. So I think there wasn't a lot of room for rampant egos.
Carl, how would you diffuse if any egos that started to blow up?
Oh, I'd pull out a gun or throw a bucket of water over someone just as they were plugging in an electric utensil.
Oh, that'll work.
No, I don't know. There weren't really any kind of artistic sort of railheads or whatever. You know, there were people were so kind of interested. They wanted to put their bit on there. I think that's the only bit of ego that happened, that people wanted to join in.
What use is it to wash that stuff away? In every place that we have run to, all that we've become with was there to stay.
I'm going to ask you all this question, and Carl, I'll start with you. What do you think you learned about the creative process by bringing all of these artists together?
I learned it's universal, and I learned that music is an amazing thing to unite people. I don't know, I just think it was such a different experience as well, because being able to play with people who you'd never be, they wouldn't come into your sphere of experience otherwise, you know, so it was a great opportunity.
Stephen Haig, let me ask you the same question. What did you learn about the creative process and watching and listening to all these artists making music together?
Well, particularly on the, working with the recordings more or less after the fact, hearing things in isolation and realizing that one performance would not have happened if it hadn't been responding to another previous performance, or, you know, these people from divergent musical cultures being in the room at the same time. Just amazing, some of the things that happened that would never have had an opportunity to have happened in any other format, really, which is a great thing about this project. It was a real unique opportunity for these people to get together. And also there's a sense of joy in the recordings, that even in some of the extended jams that I was dealing with sometimes, where people seem to be looking for ideas, someone would kind of come in from left field with something, and suddenly it would set off a whole chain reaction of things amongst the other players. And it's just a really great thing to be a part of.
I just think music's a language of communication that shouldn't exclude anyone. It's a great means of connecting and communicating emotion and ideas. And I know it's been said 1,000 times, and it's a cliche, but it became very real for us at those sessions.
Big Blue Ball is released Tuesday on Real World Records. Peter Gabriel and your colleagues, Carl and Stephen, thank you so much.
Thank you.
It's a pleasure.
Thank you very much, Leanne.
Yes, it's me. You just live it.
You can hear full songs from Big Blue Ball in the music section of NPR.org. This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Leanne Hansen.
Finally today, we bring you Grupo Fantasma, a 10-piece band from Austin, Texas. They have a new CD out. It's called Sonidos Gold. Music journalist Christian Bordahl met with some of Grupo Fantasma's members recently at a gig in Knoxville, Tennessee. And as he discovered, for a band that hasn't made it too big yet, Grupo Fantasma's been teaming up with some pretty big names.
When Prince played The Tonight Show a couple of months ago, he was backed up by the horn section of a little-known band called Grupo Fantasma. They'd heard about Prince's weekly Latin night at his club in Vegas. Here's Adrian Quesada, Grupo Fantasma's producer and guitarist.
We sent him up a CD and heard that he was going to actually listen to the CD, which was already crazy for us. For us, that would have been a story to tell our grandkids already that Prince popped our CD into the CD player. But we got a call that he liked it, and we ended up playing there. And he made us his Thursday night house band.
Grupo Fantasma was originally two bands, a funk rock outfit called Blimp and a funk jazz band called Blue Noise.
The two bands just complemented each other nicely because the Blimp was a rhythm section with the vocalist, and the Blue Noise band, we had horns.
A number of the players come from Laredo, Texas, and when they merged the two bands, bassist Greg Gonzalez says,
"We decided to try and make a blend of what we were already doing with the kind of tropical Latin influence that we had heard in the more Mexican kind of border town vibe."
These guys are clearly strong musicians. But a funk rock band doesn't just suddenly start playing traditional grooves like cumbia and rumba without doing its homework.
We feel like we really have dedicated a lot of time to actually learn, sort of dissect, you know, a lot of different traditional Latin music and really get in there and figure out what's going on, and then at the same time interpret it to where it feels natural to us.
Grupo Fantasma is very conscious of its musical roots, and on the new CD, Sonidos Gold, the band gets cameos from some of its heroes of the 1970s. On the funk side, Maceo Parker, James Brown's sax player. And from the world of Latin orchestra, Larry Harlow, one of the leaders of the Fania All-Stars. If you're going to be a professional musician and live with all the travel and the uncertainty and the craziness, then playing with a big group of friends in a fun, funky Latin orchestra seems like a pretty good way to go. Grupo Fantasma is on tour now, and the band is known for its rollicking live shows. The new studio album was recorded without much overdubbing in order to capture the energy and immediacy of their performances. You can tell that these guys are having a good time. So if you're planning to go cruising on Sunset Boulevard or just boogieing with your homies, here's to Grupo Fantasma updating some of that funky boogaloo for your summer soundtrack. For NPR News, this is Christian Bordahl.
Music journalist Christian Bordahl lives in Southern California. Grupo Fantasma's new CD is called Sonidos Gold. Day to Day is a production of NPR News with contributions from Slate.com. I'm Alex Cohen.
And I'm Madeline Brand.
Support for NPR comes from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, helping to build a more just future for the nation and the world at macfound.org. from the William and Flora Hewlett Foundation, making grants to solve social and environmental problems at home and around the world, on the web at hewlett.org. And from the Ford Foundation, a resource for innovative people and institutions worldwide, on the web at fordfound.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
The Beatles could soon be coming to a video game near you. The Financial Times reports that two big game makers are in talks with the owners of the Beatles music to create a Beatles music video game. Edward Wu is a video game analyst with Wedbush Morgan Securities. Thanks for joining us.
Great.
Well, these reports say that the two big names in the music video game world, Guitar Hero and Rock Band, are competing for the Beatles music. And it seems like it just says something that this august newspaper, the Financial Times, is talking about the video game Guitar Hero. This has really become a market phenomenon, hasn't it?
It really has. You know, music-based video games have always been around, but it's really with the launch of Guitar Hero 3 years ago that really catapulted from a little bit of a, you know, smaller niche within the sector to become one of the biggest sectors within video games.
Why are these music video games growing so fast?
I think there's always been a lot of appeal to music. You know, people always love to listen to it. People love to sing it. What happens is that video game is very interactive, and the chance to do more than just listen to music is very appealing. Plus, I think it also brings out the inner rock star in all of us. You know, who wouldn't dreamt about, you know, performing on stage and wailing away and in front of a big crowd of screaming fans.
Beatles fans tend to be baby boomers. The Guitar Hero crowd, I would think, tends to be a bit younger. Where's the intersection here?
The intersection is, you know, just the timeless lure of the music of the Beatles. I mean, you're right, it's definitely a different generation when they first launched, but with the popularity of music these days, it always seems like people always like to go back to the classics. Another trend in the video games market right now is the move towards really expanding the market from, you know, the traditional young male gamers to all ages and across, you know, both sexes. And Nintendo has shown a lot of success with the Nintendo Wii to really broaden that demographics. And with the introduction of Guitar Hero and Rock Band, it really has broadened the appeal of what people think of just young male playing video games by themselves to make it more of a social game playing experience.
The folks who own the Beatles repertoire are famously reluctant to let other people use the music. In fact, the Beatles songs still aren't even available on iTunes. Why would they team up with the video game company?
I do agree that they've been very hesitant, but I think the tidal wave of everything moving towards digital will eventually get them to turn as well, because, you know, as much as they want to have control over their music, they also recognize that they have a little bit of obligation to share the music with an entire new generation who is not going to be buying a CD or buying a record, but going to be, you know, listening to it on their iPods and going through iTunes. And in terms of being able to offer it on video games, that's another step in that direction. Of course, the Beatles are going to really control how the game is going to be played out and how much they want to distribute, but I think eventually they're going to have to do that, because otherwise they're going to be left out of entire future generations who will not be able to have the enjoyment and pleasure of listening to their music.
Edward Wu is a video game analyst with Wedbush Morgan Securities. Good talking with you.
Great talking to you.
Al Green's new album, Lay It Down, was produced by a member of The Roots, Questlove, and features cameos and songwriting collaborations with so-called neo-soul artists such as John Legend and Carine Bailey Rae. Rock critic Ken Tucker calls the result a pleasure. But does it stand up to classic Al Green records? Here's Ken's review.
At age 62, Al Green has earned the right not only to have acolytes, but to allow them to give him his proper due, which is to try and help him build a hit record. To that end, he agreed to have Amir Thompson, a.k.a. Questlove, the drummer for the hip-hop group The Roots, assemble a group of performers influenced by Al Green's prime 1970s hit singles. They did him proud, recording in New York, but capturing much of the mucky funk of the High Record Studios in Memphis, where Green recorded his greatest music with the producer Willie Mitchell. As I sit and wonder, baby, how you do the things you do, yeah. I know deep down in my heart, I'll never see all the way through. I smile. So with all this pretty music and these deep grooves, what keeps Lay It Down from being a great Al Green album? It's some mystical combination of spirituality, that is, the lack of it, and the lyrics, that is, the banality of them. Now, you might say that the man who made a hit by chanting love and happiness over and over doesn't have much need for tricky wordplay, and you're right, he doesn't. What he does need are sufficient phrases and refrains into which he can pour his smoldering passion. That's why one of the best tracks here is the tight, precise construct called I'm Wild About You, with its slamming beats and airy room for Al to improvise grunts and moans over the other nonverbal element, the woot-woots of the backup singers. Theme the new album mostly avoids is the explicit Christianity to which Green, the very active pastor of the Full Gospel Tabernacle in Memphis, has devoted much of his last 20 years of music making. The common wisdom is that once Green denied the secular in his music, it lost much of his tension. But in steering him away from God talk, his admirers have too often replaced it with mere nostalgia, summoning up memories of previous Green hits rather than moving him forward with new ones. Stay with me, my dear. Walk with me, hold me near. It's not as late as it seems. No, no. So why'd you take your love away? This album's duets with the singers Corinne Bailey Ray and John Legend, I just played the latter, are the collection's least interesting tunes. On the other hand, a song written and recorded with yet another neo-soul singer, Anthony Hamilton, has the right idea. You Got the Love I Need has a lightness that compels Green to reach for the high notes his fraying upper register can still attain with an effort that signals his enduring energy. The lyric, meanwhile, is ambiguous enough to suggest that Green and Hamilton may be making an entreaty to Jesus as much as to a woman to be seduced. If, in the end, Lay It Down is an Al Green album for Starbucks stores that already show a waning desire to push vintage soul acts, it's enough of a showcase for Green's senior citizen vigor to make you realize anew that it doesn't matter how old he is or how young his admirers are. It's the vitality and resiliency of the music that matters.
Ken Tucker is editor-at-large at Entertainment Weekly. He reviewed Al Green's new album, Lay It Down.
There is no music more melancholy than fado. This folk music from Portugal specializes in longing. As fado has become more popular internationally, many singers have tinkered with the style. In Lisbon, though, you will still find traditional performers singing with guitarists in cramped bars. Jerome Sokolowski spent an evening in one and sent this report.
It's a weekday night, and the São Miguel de Alfama is hopping. There are about a half dozen tables under the low brick arches. The club is on the ground floor of a 10th century Moorish building in the Alfama, the old waterfront district where the fado was born. No one is sure how it started, but some believe the fado began when Portuguese sailors sang about their yearning for home using African slave melodies. While one of the bar's singers performs inside, the others stand out on the cobblestone alley, smoking and exchanging jokes. One laughs that they'll never be as successful as stars like Marisa, Camané, and others who've made the fado popular overseas. These singers say they earn about $40 a night. At the São Miguel, they help wait and even bus the tables when it gets busy. José Matoso is the maitre d', the MC, and one of the fadistas. He used to drive a taxi during the day and sing at night. A few years ago, his wife convinced him to dedicate himself full-time to the clubs in the Alfama and in Lisbon's other barrios. There's a lobby that helps some people, like Marisa, Camané, and others, he says. They consider traditional fadistas like us to be poorly educated and not refined enough to be presentable in other places. Much of the global success of fado has been thanks to the introduction of other instruments like the piano and mixing it with other styles. José Matoso says most of what people hear abroad is not the real thing. The real fado is not rehearsed, he says. It's spontaneous. None of this business of let's practice in the afternoon for a performance in the evening. There is a purity to the fado sung here at the São Miguel de Alfama. The performers wear dark, elegant suits or dresses. And when they sing, they stand perfectly still, with their chins held high and their hands in their pockets or by their sides. There are fancier fado restaurants than this one, with lines of tourists waiting to get in. But the crowd at the São Miguel is overwhelmingly Portuguese, especially around midnight when a customer gets up and begins to sing. Over by the cash register stands a woman who looks like she's the boss here.
My name is Fatima Moura. I'm the owner of this restaurant São Miguel de Alfama, and I do this work with a big pleasure because I like very much my country, my traditions, and of course the fado.
She shares the singer's disdain for the internationally marketed fado.
It's nice, the sound is not bad, the voice is not bad too, but there is no soul.
But the soul is very much in evidence here as the sound of fado fills this small tavern into the early hours of a Lisbon morning. For NPR News, I'm Jerome Sokolowski in Lisbon.